the UN and Iraqi government slam U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to pardon Blackwater contractors involved in massacring Iraqi civilians in 2007. Iraqi media says a logistics convoy belonging to U.S.-led forces has come under a bomb attack in central Iraq. And a French government source says the UK has made huge concessions on fisheries in its talks with the European Union to avoid a no-deal Brexit crash out. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. U.S. President Donald Trump is facing some fierce backlash over pardoning four former Blackwater contractors jailed for massacring 14 Iraqi civilians in 2007. UN Human Rights Office said it is deeply concerned by the decision, warning pardons will contribute to impunity and embolden others to commit similar crimes. Iraq's foreign ministry also condemned the move, saying it does not take into account the gravity of the crime committed. Ministry said action is at odds with the U.S. administration's declared commitment to the values of human rights, justice, and law. Father of a 9-year-old boy who died of that massacre in Baghdad also said that Trump has once again ruined his life. Four were among 15 people pardoned this Tuesday. And several American political figures have taken to social media to voice anger at the U.S. president's decision to pardon the four Blackwater contractors. Have a listen.
Private Blackwater mercenaries Nicholas Sladen, Paul Avin Slow, even Sean Liberty, and Dustin Lauren Hurd are war criminals. Pardoning monstrous criminals will leave a dark mark on the history of presidential pardons.
Many will be wringing their hands about Papadopoulos, but in my view, the pardon of Blackwater employees is the most egregious and disgusting of Donald Trump's actions. This was a graven war crime that resulted in the death of 17 Iraqi civilians. Shame on you, Mr. President.
Pardoning these murderers is a disgrace. They shot women and kids who had their hands in the air. But it's all part of a plan to limit Biden's national security tools. These pardons will greatly damage U.S.-Iraq relations at a critical moment.
Pardons are for those wrongfully convicted. Donald Trump has chosen to pardon murderers who killed innocent Iraqi citizens, of which some were children.
The U.S. president has vetoed a major defense bill that is strongly backed by Congress. Donald Trump described the $740 billion national defense bill as a gift to Russia and China, arguing it fails to include critical national security measures. The bill was passed with overwhelming bipartisan support, having secured enough votes to override the veto. In another sign of growing frictions between the president and lawmakers, Trump threatened to veto a $2.3 trillion government funding and coronavirus aid package. Fund also pays for government operations through September 2021. So if Donald Trump blocks it, large parts of the government will start to shut down next week out of lack of funds. Joining us now out of Washington, D.C. for an update is Colin Campbell. Hey there, Colin. Thanks for joining us with this update. Tell us what the president's thinking. That's kind of conjecture there, but tell us what you think is going on with why he's vetoing what he's doing with the defense bill there, especially.
Well, I'm glad that you pointed out that a lot of it is just conjecture. It's really hard to determine the mindset of someone who is so mercurial and at times hypocritical and at other times mendacious at the very least. So what we're looking at is a multibus spending bill that the president has vetoed, saying that it does not provide enough relief for those suffering from the economic downfall caused by the global pandemic COVID-19. But what others are looking at are some of the criticisms he's had of this bill that he isn't really pushing to the forefront, and Republicans are reluctant to really showcase. And I'll go through a couple of them right now. One of them is the immunity for social media platforms to be prosecuted for filtering content or calling out what they feel are inaccurate claims on the internet. And why would the president be interested in social media? Well, it disallows him from just saying whatever he wants without any accountability on social media. Now on Twitter, his favorite social media platform of choice, is countering what he says if he makes false claims about being the next president of the United States, winning the election, other false claims. Twitter will call him out on that. He would like to prosecute social media companies that do this fact checking. He says that they are unfairly targeting conservative voices, but of course these companies feel that it's a necessary procedure because of all of the false news that the president tends to bloviate about. The other one would be the renaming of Confederate monuments and military bases or ships named after Confederate generals or Confederate military leaders. We know that the Confederacy was a block of the United States back in the 19th century, where they wanted to secede, and there was a big war trying to for them to want to break away from the United States. They also, the secessionists also believed in slavery, which is the unjust incarceration of Black Americans and indigenous peoples. Well, because of white supremacy and white hegemony here in this country that is very long standing and persistent, we have monuments and ships and military bases named after these generals that believed in slavery, that believed in seceding from the United States. And there has been a large movement to change the names to civil rights leaders, people that are more inclusive of a diverse republic. And the president has been reluctant to embrace this idea, this concept, because those in his base don't want him to. So that's another reason why he has been opposed to this legislation.
Right. And do we know why he's opposed to the fund, which is to actually, that's related to the government funding of the coronavirus aid package there, the $2.3 trillion government funding and coronavirus aid package, Colin?
Well, another reason would be that it includes some protections for people that would get coronavirus while at work, and that was another point of contention that the president did not agree with. He's also talked about not having enough aid for those suffering from coronavirus. So in some ways it would almost seem like he's leaning a little bit left here, where he said that the $600 isn't enough. But some believe that this is a smokescreen because of other issues that the president has not agreed with. He also believes that there hasn't been enough accountability for China to accept responsibility in the dissemination or the introduction of this virus into the global community. And so he has railed against that fact as well. These are all issues that the president has talked about. But again, it's very hard to know exactly which ones he is in full disagreement with, although there have been several issues that he has talked about throughout the past few weeks.
All right, thank you, bud. Stay safe in Washington. That was Colin Campbell there joining us. Meanwhile, U.S. police say that they've relieved an officer of duty after he fatally shot an unarmed Black man in the city of Columbus, Ohio. Incident unfolded Tuesday after officers responded to a non-emergency complaint about a man turning a car on and off for an extended period. Shortly after the officers arrived, the man approached them on foot with his left hand holding a cell phone. At that point, one of the officers, Adam Coy, shot 47-year-old Andre Maurice Hall. He later died at a hospital. It was the city's second law enforcement shooting death of an African-American in the past month. Hundreds of protesters demonstrated in the city on December 11th after a sheriff's deputy shot and killed 23-year-old Casey Christopher Goodson outside his home. The U.S. president has once again, in a series of Twitter posts, threatened Iran after blaming the Islamic Republic for an attack on the American embassy in Iraq. Donald Trump accused Iran of being behind Sunday's attack when three rockets landed in the U.S. embassy compound in Baghdad, damaging buildings and cars. The U.S. president has also warned to hold Tehran responsible for the death of Americans. Trump's rants come following a discussion among top American security officials on a range of options aimed at deterring attacks on U.S. establishments in Iraq. Earlier, Iran warned the U.S. not to seek tensions and conflict with the Islamic Republic. Political commentator David Yarubian says he believes that the U.S. president is not interested in starting a war.
Likely President Trump is not interested in generating a war at this point, and this would basically ruin whatever legacy he would have had in not initiating at least any new stupid American wars abroad. But I think the key figure to focus on is the self-declared Christian Zionist zealot Mike Pompeo, who also has future political interests in campaigning in mind. Who himself is chomping at the bit to start some sort of open kinetic exchange between Iran and the United States. And his tweet immediately after the rocket attack on the Green Zone, I think, is indicative of his agenda to try to foment as much ill will and potentially violence between Iran and the United States before the Trump regime exits in January. This is a man who has bragged about the training he received in the CIA to lie, cheat, and steal. We must remember, in historical context, the United States has been at war for 226 of its 244 years. That is 94% of its history.
Military convoy belonging to U.S.-led forces has reportedly come under attack in Iraq's central Bab al-Province. Iraqi media said the roadside bomb was detonated on a route of the logistics convoy, causing material damage to one of the vehicles. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments. Now, this follows the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, back in early January. Saudi hostilities against the children of Yemen continue unabated as world stays silent, watching those being starved, killed, and deprived of basics of life. Our correspondent in Yemen has your details.
Some 12 million children are facing a nightmare in Yemen, where one child dies every 10 minutes from preventable disease and the lack of healthcare services due to the ongoing war and the blockade imposed by the Saudi coalition.
We are about to enter the 7th year since the start of the aggression against our country, which has greatly affected the humanitarian situation, especially for children, who are the most affected segment in all aspects of life, such as health, education, social, and other aspects. And they have lost all the rights guaranteed by international human rights law.
The numbers of affected children continue to grow each day. 2.1 million children are acutely malnourished and 358,000 severely malnourished, meaning that some children are already suffering under famine-like conditions. Meanwhile, Yemen's Ministry of Health held a press conference to shed more light on the dire conditions of children in the country.
What the children of Yemen suffer as a result of the Saudi aggression and blockade since March 2015 is a real humanitarian catastrophe by all international standards. More than 2,400,000 children are deprived of education, and more than 3 million children are homeless. Malnutrition, which is spreading among children, has been condemned by international organizations and is said to be the result of not getting enough food.
Saudi Arabia has committed countless atrocities against children in Yemen, where children are also targeted by airstrikes. The air attacks have killed thousands of children and left thousands more suffering from disabilities, not to mention travel restrictions on thousands of patients, including children who need to travel for treatment.
As the world is silently watching an entire people being deprived of the basics of life, Yemen has become the most dangerous place in the world for children to grow up, according to UNICEF. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Britain and the European Union are reportedly on the brink of clinching a post-Brexit trade deal. European sources said an agreement is very likely Thursday morning, but talks are continuing to hammer out the details. The British government is set to hold a press conference on the issue in the morning. Reports are emerging two sides have already clinched a deal, although there has been no official confirmation from either side. A French government source said the UK has made huge concessions on fisheries to avoid a no-deal Brexit crash-out. There have been a little signs of progress in talks over recent days, with significant disagreements remaining over fisheries and fair competition.
The EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, says he will not close the door on the United Kingdom and that he remains ready to negotiate even beyond January 1st. Both sides are giving trade deal talks a final push in the hope of reaching an agreement before the UK leaves the bloc's single market on the 31st of December and has to start trading on World Trade Organization terms. SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon and London Mayor Sadiq Khan want the UK to follow EU trading rules beyond that deadline to allow more time for an agreement. But the Prime Minister says the UK will cope with any difficulties encountered.
The position is unchanged. There are problems. It's vital that everybody understands that the UK has got to be able to control its own laws completely, and also that we've got to be able to control our own fisheries. And it remains the case that WTO terms would be more than satisfactory for the UK. And we can certainly cope with any difficulties that are thrown in our way. Not that we don't want a deal, but the WTO terms would be entirely satisfactory. And prosper mightily remains an extremely good description of life after January the 1st, either way.
The UK wants sovereign control over its fishing waters that up until now were shared with Europe, which will mean Britain taking the lion's share of the catch. On the other hand, the EU wants to retain significant access to UK fisheries for boats from France, Spain, and other countries with large fleets. But some say this is the UK trying to have its cake and eat it.
Britain expects to have control of its own fishing waters and to be able to sell its fish to the EU without any tariff. That's not fair. That's not a fair trade deal. That's not a quid pro quo. And the reason that this Tory government is so up in arms about fisheries is because only a handful of families owns the fishery industry in the UK. These families are millionaires. These are Tory donors. That's the reason why they're so up in arms about protecting Britain's fishing waters. Nothing to do with sovereignty, everything to do with business, everything to do with political chicanery.
Meanwhile, stranded truck drivers and travellers have clashed with police at the UK's Dover port. France banned travel from the UK on Sunday after news of a new variant of COVID-19 spreading across southeast England. A deal was reached Wednesday between the two countries to resume travel if people test negative for the virus, but drivers are frustrated, saying there are no toilets, food, or adequate testing capabilities. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Ethiopian Human Rights Commission says armed men have killed more than 100 people in a village in the west of the country. The government-affiliated body said the pre-dawn attack took place in a village in the Metekel zone, home to multiple ethnic groups. The commission said at least 36 survivors are being treated for bullet and arrow wounds at a hospital. It added the crops were also set ablaze. Spokesperson for the government blamed anti-peace elements for the attack. On Tuesday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed traveled to the region to discuss the ethnic violence in recent months. In a tweet, he said the desire by enemies to divide Ethiopia along ethnic and religious lines still exists. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and in fact accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least 6 times higher than for whites. Although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group, only 20% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Ramzi Barud Ryder. This article is published under the heading, The Great Divider. COVID-19 reflects global racism, not equality. Here's the details of this article. The notion that the COVID-19 pandemic was the great equalizer should be dead and buried by now. If anything, the lethal disease is another terrible reminder of the deep divisions and inequalities in societies. That said, the treatment of the disease should not be a repeat of the same shameful scenario. For an entire year, wealthy celebrities and government officials have been reminding people that we are in this together and we are on the same boat. Such statements have generated much media attention, not just because they are both famous people with a massive social media following, but also because of the obvious hypocrisy in their empty rhetoric. In truth, however, they were only repeating the standard procedure followed by governments, celebrities, and wealthy influencers worldwide. With unemployment rates skyrocketing across the US and the globe, hundreds of millions scraping by to feed their children, multitudes of nameless and hapless families chugging along without access to proper health care, subsisting on hope and a prayer so that they may survive the scourges of poverty, let alone the pandemic, one cannot, with a clear conscience, make such outrageous claims. According to World Bank data, nearly half of the world lives on less than $5.5 a day. This dismal statistic is part of a remarkable trajectory of inequality that has afflicted humanity for a long time. The plight of many of the world's poor is compounded in the case of war refugees, the double victims of state terrorism and violence, and the unwillingness of those with the resources to step forward and pay back some of their largely undeserved wealth. The boat metaphor is particularly interesting in the case of refugees. millions of them have desperately tried to escape the infernos of war and poverty in rickety boats and dinghies, hoping to get across from their stricken regions to safer places. This sight has sadly grown familiar in recent years, not only throughout the Mediterranean Sea, but also in the other bodies of water around the world, especially in Burma, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have tried to escape their ongoing genocide. Thousands of them have drowned in Bay of Bengal. The COVID-19 pandemic has accentuated and in fact accelerated the sharp inequalities that exist in every society individually and the world at large. According to a June 2020 study conducted in the United States by the Brookings Institute, the number of deaths as a result of the disease reflects a clear racial logic. Many indicators included in the study leave no doubt that racism is a central factor in the life cycle of COVID. For example, among those aged between 45 and 54 years, Black and Hispanic Latino death rates are at least 6 times higher than for whites. Although whites make up 62% of the U.S. population of that specific age group, only 22% of the total deaths were white. Black and Latino communities were the most devastated. According to this and other studies, the main assumption behind the discrepancy of infection and death rates resulting from COVID among various racial groups in the U.S. is poverty, which is itself an expression of racial inequality. The poor have no or limited access to proper health care. For the rich, this factor is of little relevance. Moreover, poor communities tend to work in low-paying jobs in the service sector, where social distancing is nearly impossible. With little government support to help them survive the lockdowns, they do everything within their power to provide for their children, only to be infected by the virus or, worse, die. This inequality is expected to continue even in the way that the vaccines are made available. While several Western nations have either launched or scheduled their vaccination campaigns, the poorest nations on Earth are expected to wait for a long time before life-saving vaccines are made available. In 67 poor or developing countries located mostly in Africa and the Southern Hemisphere, only 1 out of 10 individuals will likely receive the vaccine by the end of 2020, the Fortune magazine website reported. The disturbing report cited a study conducted by a humanitarian and rights coalition, the People's Vaccine Alliance, PVA, which includes Oxfam and Amnesty International. If there is such a thing as a strategy at this point, it is the deplorable hoarding of the vaccine by rich nations. Dr. Moga Kamalyani of PVA put this realization into perspective when she said that rich countries have enough doses to vaccinate everyone nearly 3 times over, while poor countries don't even have enough to reach health workers and people at risk. So much for the numerous conferences touting the need for a global response to the disease. But it does not have to be this way. While it is likely that class, race, and gender inequalities will continue to ravage human societies after the pandemic, as they did before, it is also possible for governments to use this collective tragedy as an opportunity to bridge the inequality gap, even if just a little, as a starting point to imagine a more equitable future for all of us. Poor, darker-skinned people should not be made to die when their lives can be saved by a simple vaccine, which is available in abundance.
Iqbal, obviously being a scholar, we say Allama Iqbal as well. He was a mystic. He knew Quran very well. In his poetry, we can see, you know, interpretation of Quran as well. So he basically was referring back towards the original Islam.
One very important factor about his character was that he was a concerned person. You know, he had the concerns for the society, for the people, for the human beings. He was a person who constantly thought about others and finding solutions for the betterness of the society and betterness of the world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear brothers and sisters, all across the nation of Islam. This is The Teacher, an introduction to the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers, philosophers, and scholars all across the world, with the presence of two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome, and Dr. Rezazadeh, assalamu alaikum to you, and welcome to the show, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for having me.
So, in this new series of the program, The Teacher, we are concerned with some of the outstanding and prominent Muslim thinkers and scholars. And for this episode and the upcoming ones, we have selected Muhammad Iqbal, who was a famous poet, scholar, and politician of India, now present Pakistan, and in fact, whose poetry and some of his works in politics were really outstanding, and his vision, in fact, of the independent states of the Muslims for British India was to inspire the creation of Pakistan at that time, and he's commonly referred to as Allama Iqbal, a polymath or a scholar. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, you yourself are from Pakistan, and you have really fruitful information about Allama Iqbal Lahuri or Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Give us some background about his early life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Allama Muhammad Iqbal, they call him Lahuri because he's buried in Lahore. Mm-hmm. Whereas he was born on 9th of November 1877 in Sialkot.
That's right.
And Sialkot is a city which is towards the east of Lahore. It's around like 2 and 2.5 hour drive from Lahore to Sialkot. And it's a border area between like India and Pakistan.
Is it Sialkot?
Sialkot.
Sialkot, okay.
Sialkot.
Okay.
Because in Persian you don't have T.
No.
So
it's
so,
hard. It's yeah. We have T, but it's hard to pronounce it this yeah. way, okay?
Yeah, but so. They pronounce it as Sialkot.
Okay.
And obviously he was the son of Sheikh Muhammad, who was a tailor basically.
Mm-hmm.
And he studied his initial studies in the city of Sialkot. And after that, like after schooling, he went to Murray College. This Murray College, obviously, if you search on the internet, they show it's his previous name.
No.
It's been changed. It was Scotch Mission School or College.
Okay.
And later it was changed to the name of Murray College.
What is Murray? Murray means Mary?
Murray, M-U-R-R-Y, it's a Christian name.
Oh, Christian
Murray.
Name. Yeah. These are Christian names.
These are the Christians. Scotch was the first head of the school who went there, the missionary, and then the Murray, it was changed to Murray College, basically.
Okay.
So that is also a missionary school.
That's right.
The point is that when he was in Murray College, he became the student of Sayyid Mir Hassan.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of information about this teacher, his teacher, Sayyid Mir Hassan.
That's right.
The things that we have, it is said like he learned the Quranic teachings, the Quranic studies,
yes,
and the Arabic language from Sayyid Mir Hassan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Sayyid Mir Hassan who basically, we can say like, who told him to go for the further studies to Lahore and then to study in the college and universities.
That's right.
Sayyid Mir Hassan himself, if I just want to say about him a couple of words,
okay,
it would be enough to say that when Allama Iqbal wrote his books, his thesis,
yes, right,
the British government, they announced to give him a certification or, you know, a title.
That's right.
For example, the title of Sir was given, yes, by the British government, yes, at that time.
Yes.
When they were about to give this title, he said, you should give a title to my teacher, Sayyid Mir Hassan.
Mm-hmm.
And Sayyid Mir Hassan, they said, we don't have any book from him, anything from him.
Okay.
He said, his book is Iqbal.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're giving me a title, you should give a title to my teacher.
Okay.
Now, the point is, when he was getting this title of Sir from, that's the right, British government,
okay,
he did not mention anyone else,
yes,
except Sayyid Mir Hassan.
That's all right.
So it shows that the Sayyid Mir Hassan, basically, he nurtured him,
that's
in
right,
a way.
As a mentor.
That, right. As a mentor. He was, yes, the, right, best mentor for him.
Yes.
Who guide him towards the path which he followed throughout his life.
Okay, that's right.
And that's why at that time then the British government, they gave Sayyid Mir Hassan the title of Shamsul Ulama.
Okay.
The son of the scholars.
Yes, that's right.
Iqbal, obviously, he finished his college studies,
mm-hmm,
we can say like 12th grade.
Yes.
In Sialkot. After that, he moved to Lahore, where he joined the government college. And there he studied law.
Mm-hmm.
He did his BA and master's in philosophy in Government College of Lahore, which is now known as the Government College University. It became a university.
Okay.
And after that, he went to the Cambridge, where he did law. And after, yes, that, he went to the Munich University, where, yes, he did his PhD in philosophy.
He was truly a polymath, you know, now different fields of studies, from literature to, we can say, Quranic studies, and also law. He was a barrister, he was a lawyer.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a lawyer, we can say, in British India at that time. And the role that Iqbal's mother had in nurturing this son, you know, it is documented that Iqbal's mother, Imam Bibi,
Imam Bibi,
was a woman who was generous, wise, very much fond of reading the Holy Quran. This for surely had direct role in nurturing the character of Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Dr. Azad, let's get to you, brother. What makes Allama Muhammad Iqbal Lahori very special? He's very much welcomed in Iran too.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Whenever we want to talk about these, you know, very influential characters, we really need to pay attention to many different things that has really shaped their personality. And when we look at the life of a person like Muhammad Iqbal, we see that he has been influenced by many important factors. First, we see that he comes from a very important family root.
Mm-hmm.
His very, old ancestors come from Brahmin Hindus, but they converted into Islam. Some people say 2 centuries before his birth, and some others say that 4 centuries before his birth. But they were from the clergy class and the scholars in their own faith tradition. But then it comes to him, and as you mentioned, his mother, yes, and his family, they were all important factors,
that's
in
right,
shaping a strong personality. And this is a very common factor that we can see in the lives of many important and influential figures in the history. When they have a very original and influential family,
that's right,
that really helps them. The other thing that we can see in his life is that he has a very good opportunity to study under the best teachers and mentors, and also go to some of the best universities and see some of the most influential, professors, that's of his right, time. So he not only studied under important people, yes, but also socialized with very influential figures of his time. For example, we see Thomas Arnold,
yeah,
and Edward, yes, Brown and Reynold Nicholson.
That's,
you know,
right,
these are very important figures of his time who were very in, yeah, close relationship with,
especially,
him.
Arnold, his PhD thesis was dedicated to him,
yeah,
after Mr. Arnold. And it says, because he judged me liberally,
right,
regardless of my color, regardless of my religion or faith, That's why Professor Arnold has a specific place in his thought.
Exactly. And you know, this is really a blessing of God that gives to some people this opportunity to be in touch with so many influential people. Okay. And as a result of all of these, let's say, important factors, we see that such a person is emerged.
That's
and
right.
That's about, let's say, exterior factors, but in his own character, we see important things. For example, we see that he was very hardworking.
Yes.
He really took advantage of opportunities that God gave to him. And also, one very important factor about his character was that he was a concerned person. You know, he had the concerns for the society, for the people, for the human beings.
Yes.
He was a person who constantly thought about others and finding solutions for the betterness of the society and betterness of the world. And this really makes a person very different.
And as a Muslim, as a current Muslim on that time, that's why he decided to dedicate his life, his time, his all the studies regarding law. We should not neglect it, because in establishing a new country and introducing a new law system to the world, this constitution is very important. And it seems that Iqbal and Allama Iqbal Lahori had a specific and comprehensive framework in his mind, Said Mohsen, isn't it, in order to establish the Muslim League or the Pakistan at that time.
Yeah, that's true. And obviously, we can see in his work, because he was very inspired by Sayyid Hassan, Sayyid Mir Hassan, who was obviously Sayyidul Ulama or Shamsul Ulama. And living in a society where we had like the non-Muslims and Muslims together. Obviously, in that society, there were many issues. On top of that, if we look at his poetry, we can see how he is describing about the honor and the status of the Muslim Ummah.
That's right.
And obviously the dignity that they should have.
Okay.
And what's happening now? What did Prophet said about the Muslim Ummah? What does Quran says? What did Allah says? And how the Muslims are living now?
That's right.
Obviously, at that time, we can see the Muslims were oppressed. There were other people who were oppressed by the either British government or the others. But he has in his mind that living in a society where some people, they worship, for example, cow, and on the other hand, there are some other people who are eating cow, the meat, so there's a contradiction. And obviously, there was always these kinds of problems over there. So regardless of being like a barrister, because he practiced as a barrister in Lahore when he came back to Lahore, but apart from that, he had this pain that the Muslim Ummah, when they are in a big and large number, they should live liberally.
That's right.
And they should perform their actions or the deeds or the religious, you can say, rituals, we can say, like, freely. And that was the main idea, which was known as, generally in the books, it is written as Do Qomi Nazriya. Like in Urdu, in
two
history,
nation theory.
Two nation theory,
that's right.
We can find, like, it is very much apparent, like, two nations theory.
Yeah, that's right.
In which he gave this theory.
Okay.
And that's why he joined the Muslim League.
Yes.
Muslim League was the only Muslim, you can say, like, group that was basically working for the independence of the Muslims in Indo-Pak.
We will get, inshallah, more political aspect. But, Dr. Azazel, let's get to you. We got about 2 minutes. To the end of today's program. What other factors do you think made Iqbal Lahori a very special one and maybe neglected brother among the modern generation of the Muslims? Iqbal Lahori is very much neglected, not very much remembered of, isn't it?
I think so, because he really deserves much more attention. That's the point. We, you know, among some people, among some of the thinkers, he's very well known because they are familiar with the depth of his thoughts. But when it comes to the general people, not many people know
maybe
about...
Maybe it is because his literary character maybe overshadows his political one and the leading one, but...
Yeah, but also some people only look at him as a political thinker, but not as a philosopher and as a...
really, really deep thinker who had original ideas.
Okay.
So this is one thing. But at the end of the day, we should say that the most important thing about him is that he had a very comprehensive and multidimensional character.
That's right.
He was a philosopher, a mystic somehow, a poet, a lawyer who was really familiar right. with you know, the international law, and also he was, and you can really find it in his works, that he was very much familiar with the sciences like physics and right. also psychological theories.
That's right.
And based on all of them, at the same time, he was a person of practice.
That's right.
He wanted to be a spiritual person, and he was a spiritual person.
That's right.
You can find it from his lifestyle. Yes. Was not only a scholar or
no, he was a practicing Muslim.
Yeah, he was a very pious yeah. practicing Muslim. Okay. I can say it that way. And he spent a good amount of his time just for worshiping
That's
and
right.
having spiritual
okay.
time.
Yes.
So all of these things make him a very successful person that we really need to
okay.
learn more about him and get more from his works.
That's
inshallah.
Right. Thank you very much. Inshallah, we'll dedicate some of our upcoming sessions also to Iqbal Lahuri, also known as Allama Muhammad Iqbal, also Sir Muhammad Iqbal. Okay, these are different titles with him. But what is known is that he's in the Muslim lands, among the Muslim thinkers, he's known as Allama Muhammad Iqbal. It was very kind of you, Dr. Murtaza Razazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, and dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. We hope you enjoyed this first episode of the program, The Teacher on Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Do not forget to log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page, or our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
when U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jay Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading Fewer Jobs and Rising Poverty. Scathing report finds Trump's economic legacy one of the worst among all U.S. presidents. Stay tuned, please, for the details. When U.S. President Donald Trump departs the White House next month, he will leave in his wake a nation devastated by a pandemic he failed to confront and an economic scene characterized by rising poverty, widespread hunger, a looming eviction tsunami, and mass layoffs that have left the U.S. with fewer jobs than when his administration began. And for that, a scathing new report by Democrats on the Congressional Joint Economic Committee, JEC, argues the outgoing president only has himself to blame. Released on Friday, December 18th, in response to the 2020 economic report of the president, the assessment of the Trump's economic performance during his 4 years in office runs directly counter to the rosy depiction frequently offered by the president himself, who seldom missed an opportunity to boast about the state of the stock market even in the midst of nationwide material suffering brought on by the coronavirus pandemic. American businesses and workers are struggling to survive because President Trump refused to listen to advice from public health experts and economists about the best way to handle the coronavirus. Representative Don Beyer, the incoming JEC chair, said in a statement, "In fact, his handling of the coronavirus will hurt the economy for years to come. That is President Trump's economic legacy, one of the worst among all U.S. presidents." The new report examines Trump's economic record dating back to the beginning of his administration, which began with soaring promises on jobs, trade, wages, healthcare, and other key policy matters. While Trump inherited a steadily improving economy, the president failed to pursue policies that would sustain and strengthen the economic expansion, the JEC report argues. As many analysts predicted before its passage and implementation, the $1.5 trillion tax cuts on jobs that Trump signed into law in December of 2017 delivered most of its benefits to the rich and failed to produce anything resembling an economic boom. President Trump's televised claim that the tax cuts would be one of the great Christmas gifts to the middle-income people proved to be deeply misleading, the JEC report notes. Analysis reveals that the tax cuts heavily favored the very wealthy, with the top 1% of households, those with average incomes of almost $2 million, projected to receive an average tax break of nearly $50,000 in 2020. This is approximately 64 times the average tax cut of the middle 20% of households, who were projected to receive an average tax cut of $780, the report continues. The poorest 20% were projected to receive an average tax cut of just $60. Trump's trade promises were similarly empty, the report finds. The presence of touted trade war with China resulted in hundreds of thousands of lost U.S. jobs. A study by Moody's Analytics found that by September 2019, it had cost the U.S. economy nearly 300,000 jobs, the JEC notes. While the president's economic performance prior to the coronavirus pandemic was far from successful, Trump's handling of the COVID-19 crisis and resulting economic collapse was catastrophic, pushing millions more into poverty and leaving countless Americans unable to afford basic necessities. At present, the U.S. has around 10 million fewer jobs than it did at the start of the pandemic. The JEC observes that after Congress and the White House approved the $2.2 trillion CARES Act in March, providing a temporary $600 per week boost to unemployment benefits and a round of one-time stimulus payments to many Americans, the administration and Senate Republicans refused to work to negotiate another package until a few weeks before the expiration of the unemployment supplement, a lapse that dramatically slashed the incomes of millions of people in the U.S. The administration's mismanagement of the coronavirus and its grudging response to limit the resulting economic damage have exposed and widened vast structural inequalities, the report states. Low-income workers and people of color have been most harmed by COVID-19 and the ensuing recession. They are more likely to be exposed to the virus, to be hospitalized, and to die from it. The JEC Democrats conclude that by all objective measures, job growth, unemployment, gross domestic product, Trump leaves the economy in much worse condition than he found it. However, the numbers do not tell the whole story. His failure to use the power of the presidency to fight the coronavirus will weigh down the U.S. economy for years to come, the report says. His successor will be left with an extraordinary challenge to reverse the failure of the Trump administration. He must also move beyond them to ensure that the United States builds back better from this crisis, fully utilizing the talents and resources of all its people to build an economy that is fairer, stronger, more inclusive, and more resilient.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.